Well, she's back, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton-Howe, with some incredible stories that will keep you on the edge of your chair. And we'll be right back with Linda in a moment. We'll get right into these stories. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton-Howe, with us. Linda, how are you?
Well, good. I'm really glad that I'm not in Chicago.
And
my heart goes out to everybody in that part of the world. But I guess one of the upsides is that maybe there will be a little bit more control on insects like it used to be.
Maybe, yeah.
But this is polar vortex climate change, and I guess we better get used to it.
Of course, by the weekend, they're going to be up there in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
So yeah, like a yo-yo.
It's unbelievable. So you've been working on a story about these incredible radio bursts. Tell me about this.
It is quite a mystery, and it has this question that comes from astronomers everywhere now. What has been making at least 70 very powerful and fast radio bursts over the past two decades from many different parts of our universe, not just one, including at least 18 from the same small galaxy 2.5 billion light years from Earth, where the phenomenon was first seen to repeat from the same unknown source on November 2nd, 2012. That repeater was known as FRB 121102, related to the date that it was recorded. And the significance of that repeating fast radio burst was that whatever was emitting the powerful energy burst was not destroying the emitter. This fact has astonished astrophysicists because the power of these mysterious fast radio bursts is 500 million times the power of our solar system's sun. That's half a billion suns.
Jeez.
Yeah. But each documented burst to date has lasted only about 3 to 5 milliseconds. And, George, no afterglow. It doesn't seem possible. Now, this month on June 9th, 2019, the journal Nature contained a report from Canadian astronomers who have discovered 13 new fast radio bursts, and only the second repeating fast radio burst since that FRB 121102 7 years ago. This new repeater is known as FRB 180725A, and this is, you can see at myearthfiles.com tonight, that I have a dynamic spectrum of these two spectra of this repeating that has just been reported. The instrument that caught these FRBs is a new radio telescope in British Columbia called CHIME, C-H-I-M-E.
Hmm.
It's an acronym for Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment. Astrophysicist Ingrid Stairs, Ph.D., professor of astronomy in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, said, quote, "We certainly hope that the new CHIME telescope was going to be able to discover a lot of fast radio bursts, and we had the good luck to find 13 of these things in the pre-commissioning phase," close quote. That means that the CHIME telescope was not even running at its fullest capacity and was only working at about and looking at 25% of the cosmic sky that it had originally been constructed to study when it's in full operation. This CHIME research is the first time that FRBs have been detected in the 400 to 800 megahertz radio band. Previously, FRBs were mostly found near 1400 megahertz. Now, another astounding FRB research fact was pointed out by astronomer Shirharsh Tendulkar, a member of the CHIME team at Canada's McGill University. For fast radio bursts to be detected in other galaxies far from Earth, that is in the Milky Way galaxy, it means that an extremely powerful magnetic field is producing a signal along the radio frequency band that, quote, has to be trillions of times brighter than a pulsar. That's one followed by 12 zeros. That is huge. We have no idea how to make something that bright, close quote. Well, astrophysicist Ingrid Stairs is encouraged by this second repeating fast radio burst that CHIME discovered and says, quote, the fact that we found a second one so quickly implies that there could be a lot more repeaters out there, close quote. And here now from Vancouver, Canada, is astrophysicist Ingrid Stairs.
We found that one of our 13 fast radio bursts was repeating. There had been a new burst recorded, and some alert person in the collaboration said, hey, wait a minute, that comes from basically the same position on the sky, and it has the same amount of dispersion as this burst that went off in August. And so then we started really combing through all of our data very carefully, and we found that there were, in fact, several other events that had gone off.
What you're saying is that you've now found a repeater, and that that repeater has repeated six times in your data.
That's right. We have six separate pulses from this thing in our data, or six separate bursts. And they came on different days, so they're too far apart in time for us to really be able to tell if there's any regularity, and we don't know if there is going to be any repetition like that. The first repeater doesn't really show any kind of periodicity in it, but we'll have to have a lot more data in order to get to that.
You're interested in the possibility of periodicity because it might mean that it was something that was repeating a process that is causing the fast radio burst?
Yes. Most of the reasonable models for the fast radio burst, some kind of compact object like a neutron star or a black hole, there are many neutron stars that have quite high magnetic fields and are magnetars, and many of these give off quite loud bursts of energy. We've seen them mostly at X-ray and gamma-ray energies within our own galaxies. Some of them emit in radio as well. The energetics aren't perfect, but it may be that these are related to fast radio bursts in some way. So if they are neutron stars, we'd expect them to be spinning and rotating, and so if the emission is coming from a particular place on the surface of the star, then we would expect that to be reflected in some kind of periodicity.
Isn't the significance of the fact that that was a repeater, and your new work is a repeater, that whatever this enormous energy is, it did not destroy the source?
Exactly. That is a crucial point that I was getting to. One of the things the repeater did was to make the point that for at least some of these fast radio bursts, whatever was causing the radio emission could not destroy the source. Up to that point, there had been a lot of theories that involved two neutron stars merging or some star being destroyed by a companion, that kind of thing. So for at least the repeaters, we know that it can't be a completely destructive event that happens. This doesn't necessarily mean that all FRBs are the same as repeaters. We're still trying to disentangle whether they are two separate classes of events, repeaters and non-repeaters, or if there are similarities between them and they have the same ultimate radio burst production mechanism. We don't know that at this stage. Hopefully that's one of the questions we'll eventually be able to answer, because the CHIME telescope should be able to find lots and lots and lots of FRBs over the next several years. But anyway, that you know, with the publication of several more one-off fast radio bursts, gets us up to about the time when it turned on. So the state was that we knew of about 60 or so of these fast radio bursts, and one of those was a repeater. We have learned something new about fast radio bursts just with the initial set of detections from CHIME. And what I mean by that is that most of the fast radio bursts that have been detected up to that point were at comparatively high radio frequencies, around 1.4 gigahertz. That's a frequency that's used a lot in radio astronomy because hydrogen has a nice strong emission line there. There had been one fast radio burst detected at around 800 megahertz, which happens to be at the top of the CHIME observing band. But other surveys that had been conducted at lower frequencies, like 300 to 400 megahertz, had not found anything. So we were a bit worried that maybe at the lower part of our band, which runs from 400 to 800 megahertz, or, you know, sort of in the general region of where broadcast TV is and cell phone signals, we were worried that at the low end of our band, maybe the signals wouldn't be there. They might be scattered completely so that they were spread out and made invisible. So we were a little bit concerned that we might not see much in the lower part of our band. But with these 13 first fast radio bursts that we've seen in our early pre-commissioning period, we do see several that have emission down to 400 megahertz, which is great. That means that they are visible at these low frequencies. They're not all completely scattered, although many of them do show a good amount of scattering as well. So that's something we've learned right off the bat. Another thing that came out of these 13 first fast radio bursts is that based on the amount of scattering that we do see, which is sort of a smearing out of the pulse and has to be caused by reasonably dense regions of ionized gas, is that if the fast radio bursts are coming from Milky Way type galaxies, then they have to be coming from slightly special regions within those galaxies. Maybe a place where there are lots of new stars being formed, maybe inside a young supernova remnant, or maybe close to a very massive black hole. We can't tell the difference between those possibilities. All we can say is that the density of the ionized gas needs to be fairly high around the places where these things are produced.
Do you think that both of the repeating fast radio bursts have come from that same dwarf galaxy?
No. They were coming from different directions on the sky.
Completely?
Yeah, completely different directions.
Let's shift gears to the hypotheses of what fast radio bursts could be. I have interviewed Avi Loeb, the chair of the Harvard Astronomy Department. He and others have had these fascinating proposals. One was published.
Yes.
That the fast radio bursts could be signatures of the laser energy that they're now going to start trying to use in Project Starshot to see if they can get small computers traveling at 20 or 30% the speed of light by laser push, laser sails.
Yeah.
And headed toward whether it's Mars or Alpha Centauri or where. Now, it is such an interesting idea that I wonder, can you take us through your thinking about the possibility that what we're trying to do with Project Starshot now might be like an advanced version out there with these fast radio bursts?
Well, you know, I'm pretty skeptical of any alien explanation for these things. I mean, they're coming from all different directions on the sky, right? They're seen with telescopes in Australia. They're seen with telescopes here in Canada, you know, in the northern part of the sky and the southern part of the sky, all kinds of different distances. It just seems really inconceivable that groups of aliens in all these different galaxies would have the same kind of signaling technology, laser technology, whatever, happening at the same time, you know, and then being directed toward us.
The reason why we only saw a fast radio burst for the very first time in 2001 data and reported in 2007 and not before 2001, what is that reason?
Well, that's because it wasn't until sort of the 90s or so that people were sampling fast enough in order to even make a detection of these things. The signal is going up and then down again with a time scale of 3 milliseconds. If you're doing a survey where you're sampling at, say, 10 milliseconds, the signal is going to get mostly washed out. It might show up in one sample, but it wouldn't be as bright as it would be if you had it sampled at 3 milliseconds or even better, 1 or half a millisecond. The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, yes, there may be about 1,000 of these going off every day in the sky, but the sky is really big and you have to be looking in the right place at the right time in order to see them. Part of the reason we found so many of these things with CHIME is that we have quite a large field of view. And so we have a better chance of finding anything at all just because we're staring at such a large part of the sky.
What are your next steps to follow up the research that you've published in Nature having to do with staying on top of what's happening with fast radio bursts?
Yeah, well, so we were still looking for new things with CHIME, and we're going to try to get time with the repeater on interferometric telescopes and hopefully get a good localization of it. as we're also introducing this new capability on Chime where we'll be able to sort of store snippets of the data for the brightest bursts and really process it in many different ways. And hopefully we'll get a handle not just on their position, but on shorter timescale structure that we currently can't see, and maybe some information about the magnetic field as well. So a lot that should still come out of Chime in the next several years.
And if you start seeing more and more repeaters, where will that research go?
Well, that would be great. Hopefully we'd be able to observe them all with interferometers and really find their positions on the sky and see what kinds of commonalities there are for those sources. You know, are they in the same kinds of regions, in the same kinds of galaxies? Do they come from all kinds of different places? How are they related to the fast radio bursts that only seem to go off once? But I think there's a lot to be found out there, and more examples and more observations will help us to do that.
Sounds like she wanted to say, Linda, that they're coming from unusual places, but she held back.
Well, I'll tell you, Professor Avi Loeb at Harvard doesn't hold back. I've interviewed him a couple of times about the whole concept of the fast radio burst. And it was just in the past couple of years that he had a paper that was published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters as chair of Harvard University's astronomy department and director of Harvard's Institute for Theory and Computation and the Black Hole Initiative. And he is on Project Starshot. And he proposed with a Harvard co-author that fast radio bursts could be interstellar light sails, an advanced transportation system that was pushing payloads up to 1 million tons each,
wow.
I'm quoting from his paper, large enough to carry living passengers across interstellar or even intergalactic distances. This is, close quote, the head of Harvard University's astronomy department. And in one of our interviews, he said to me, Linda, quote, if our civilization on Earth is now contemplating doing Starshot, which is kind of projecting with lasers, mm-hmm. and they might try this in about another year or two, that they would start off with something small and light and maybe get it up to 20 or 30% of the speed of light, because it would be small. It would be like pushing an iPhone with a laser, but would have a shield on it. And if they start doing that now, he said, there might be another advanced technological civilization that already has mastered this technology, went far ahead, and so that now that what we're seeing with these bursts of 500 million suns of energy, and not just in one part of this universe, but all over the place, that they are actually evidence of launching advanced large cargoes. Now, that is fascinating because he's not the only astronomer and astrophysicist who is linking this concept that if you reach a point where you could start launching small things and build, work your way up into heavier cargo, that where we are now sort of beginning to tiptoe into, can we use laser light to project something going at 20%, 30%, 40%, and on and on and on the speed of light, that would bring Alpha Centauri, for example, one way, maybe if we got up to near the speed of light, it would be about 4 years away. And so in one scientist's lifetime, he could have a round-trip research project at Alpha Centauri, right, if we could figure out a way to put something there to send it back.
Right under his nose as well. Thanks, Linda. When we come back, she begins a special three-part series of alien abductions. And welcome back, Linda Moulton Howe with us with the three special reports now on incredible UFO abduction cases. Go ahead, Linda.
Thanks, George. You know, over the last 40 years, I've interviewed at least 1,600 people in the human abduction syndrome. And this story that I'm going to get into now has some of the most extraordinary evidence in terms of X-rays that I or others have ever seen. And it is like one of these moments where we've all wanted something that could possibly be definitive and that doctors could look at and say, this is extraordinary, and this is this story. It starts in Devil's Den State Park in Missouri. That's a park that covers 2,500 acres in Washington County. Mm-hmm. It's near West Fork in northwestern Arkansas, and the ground is largely sandstone. In fact, it's the largest concentration in the United States. It was built in 1933 by the Civilian Conservation Corps, and it was named after a local cave called Devil's Den. That 20th century name echoed what the region had become in the 19th century. All the sandstone caves, the bluffs, the ravines, and crevices were perfect hideouts for outlaws in the 1800s until the American Civil War that began in 1861. And that's when guerrilla fighters in the Confederacy hid out and attacked Union Army supply lines and civilians. Even the only town ever built at Devil's Den was destroyed by a flood in 1893, leaving only the cemetery. But by the 1970s, Devil's Den State Park was renovated with pavilions, cabins, trails, a dam, and spillway on Lee Creek that forms Lake Devil. And that's when two U.S. Air Force buddies living in Missouri and serving at Whiteman Air Force Base decided that June 1977, in their early 20s, would be a perfect time to try camping at Devil's Den Park. That summer, Terry Lovelace was in his fourth year of a six-year term with the U.S. Air Force from October 25, 1973 to October 24, 1979. That was the term of his service. Terry was happily married and best friends with a colleague he calls Toby, who was also happily married. But for this first camping trip, the two men decided it would be safer and easier to go on their own without their wives. Well, what happened in their first hours at their campsite is now the subject of a 2018 book entitled Incident at Devil's Den, A True Story by Terry Lovelace, Esquire. He was an attorney, became an attorney after his Air Force years. Terry is now 63 years old, and that Juris Doctor degree that he earned from Western University of Michigan Law School after his Air Force days was put him into a legal career in private practice in civil litigation and criminal defense. He entered public service as an assistant attorney general and later as general counsel for LBJ Tropical Medical Center in the U.S. territory of American Samoa. And then later, he was an assistant attorney general for the state of Vermont until his retirement in 2012. The following interview begins with what happened after those two men set up their tent and were looking at the night sky when Toby was first to see three stars in a triangular pattern that his amateur astronomer eyes did not recognize. Here now is attorney Terry Lovelace from Garland, Texas.
Toby turns his head to the left and he says, hey, man, over there, those three stars, what are they? And then they moved. They rotated at first, turned like they were on an axis, and they rotated almost 360 degrees. We were excited. Hey, wow, look at this. Have you ever seen anything like this? They stopped, and then they started to move straight up in the air. The higher they got, the further apart the three points of light of this triangle grew apart, and you could see that inside the three stars of this triangle, it was jet black as opposed to the night sky outside, which was dark blue. This was one solitary object, and we saw it move past stars, and they would blink out until it had moved past, and then the star would blink back on, and that confirmed that, yeah, we're looking at one solid object. And this thing eventually moves and stops directly over our heads, and it is enormous. I'm guessing 3,000 feet in the air.
Any sound from this huge thing?
No, we didn't hear any sound, and the tree frogs and the normal sounds of the forest was very, very still. And Toby said, he had this cheap flashlight, and he said, I'm going to signal it. And he held the flashlight up over his head, and he flashed it three times. As soon as he brought his hand down and laid the flashlight down, directly from the center and underneath of this thing, there came a column of white light. And it was only about 6 inches in diameter, and it was centered directly in the middle of our campfire, which was now just pretty much embers anyway. A pencil-thin, bluish-purplish light came on from underneath dead center of this triangle, and it hit the campsite, and this little beam of light, it was like someone flipped a switch, it would be on for a millisecond, then they flip the switch off, and then it would move, and then flip it back on. So we never saw the light move. We just saw it turn on, and it would be here, and then there, and then here, and then there, and dancing all around the campsite. And then that stopped, and we both just lay there. And Toby says, I guess show's over. And I grabbed my air mattress. He had his, and we dragged them into our little tent. And I didn't bother to undress. I didn't bother to take my boots off. And I fell on this air mattress. And the last thing I remember was hearing Toby snoring softly. And I was just out. My next memory is noise. And this is like an engine running. It's not so much loud as it is powerful. If you've ever stood next to a train locomotive, there's that strong pulsing that reverberates in your chest. I could hear this noise. I'm awake, but I'm not with it. I am trying to claw my way back into consciousness. And there's this flood of greenish and white and occasionally yellow, but mostly greenish and white light flashing into our tent and lighting it up like a 300-watt bulb in these flashes. I get up and I realize that I'm in a lot of pain. Every muscle in my body hurt. Got to my knees, and that's when I could see that Toby had been crying, because I could see tracks of tears down his face. My God, what could move this man to tears? He was shaking. I realized I was trembling too. So something was out there. Toby's on his knees. He's peeking out through this tent, through the little flap. And I pull the flap back and I look out and I see these little kids. And there's about a dozen, maybe 15. And they're paired up in groups of twos and threes, kind of wandering around this meadow. And that's when Toby said, those ain't no little kids. They took us, Terry. Do you remember, Terry? They took us and they hurt us. I was absolutely terrified out of my wits. Never in my life had I been so scared. This thing that we watched, that we saw earlier in the evening, had descended. It's now 30 feet over the meadow. So now we could see, because it was so close, how big this thing actually was. The city block on each leg of the triangle. And I estimated its height at 5 stories. It was like someone had levitated a 5-story office building and suspended it 30 feet over this meadow. A column of white light about 30 feet in diameter, shining down from the center of this thing. And we're watching these little guys. Clearly, these were not humans. Like, their knees bent backward. It was like their knees were hinged both ways.
You saw their knees swivel from front to back to front to back?
Yeah, kind of. Yes. This was not the gait of a human being. Also, the tips of their hands was with their knees. Their arms were longer than they should have been. Their heads were disproportionately large, but not grotesquely so. We weren't close enough that I could see clearly their eyes or facial features. But these little guys would walk in pairs and in threes into this column of light and stop. And then they would dissolve. In the span of about 2 seconds in this light, they would just disappear. I can recall the sensation of leaving the tent, and that was a brilliant white flash and a twirling sensation. And then it was like, boom, we're in there.
In that big triangular craft.
When I found myself inside, the interior gave the impression that it was twice as large. The interior size did not match the exterior size.
Mm-hmm. And what were you seeing in that huge interior space?
First thing that I noticed was the lights. There were light panels all over the place, and it was brilliantly lit on the inside, so much so that it hurt my eyes. My eyes were nearly swollen shut, as were Toby's after this incident. But the inside of the place was just incredibly brightly lit. Everything was stainless steel or white. There were light panels on the floor, on the walls, and on the ceiling that emitted light. I saw three flying saucers, three discs, and they were lined up in a neat little row, just like aircraft below a carrier deck. There were some type of legs supporting them. There was a dome in the center that was kind of smoothly molded into the top of the thing. There were panels that I thought were windows.
What were their shape?
Square, perfectly square.
What happens?
Toby and I were standing next to one another, and we were paralyzed. All I could move was my eyes, and I assume that's all that Toby could move. I'm straining my eyes to look at these saucers. That's when I noticed there were a group of people that were all nude, and they were frozen like us.
These are other humans?
They are other human beings. They're nude, and it's a mixture of men, women, and children. They're close enough that you could see the terror in their eyes. They were as afraid as we were, but they were segregated from us. We weren't a part of their group.
Did you have any instinct to call to them?
I could not. I couldn't speak. There were two other things that happened there that were very important, and that was I noticed the guys that were other human beings, they wore distinctive uniforms, tan uniforms with a round patch insignia on their shoulders, and they were five or six. One of them was a woman who appeared to be Hispanic or Latino. She had her hair in a ponytail. The other men that we saw were all guys our age, 22, with military haircuts, trim and fit, completely ignored us, would not look in our direction, would not look in the direction of the other people.
Terry, am I understanding that you had the impression that in addition to you and Toby, a group of humans that are all nude, paralyzed, male, female, and children, that there were five or six what looked to you like human beings in these beige jump uniforms with a perhaps orange round patch on these uniforms, that these humans in uniform seemed to be working independent of you and Toby and this other group of humans in this huge ship?
They did not seem to be hybrid. They just gave me the impression that they were human beings.
Why would human beings from Earth be working in a capacity that looks almost military-like inside of a huge triangle that at Devil's Den in Arkansas, you and Toby have been picked up by a beam?
You know, I ask that question every day of my life. Huge question. I can draw the assumption that these human beings were working in concert with the ETs. The little guys, I called them worker bees, and the little guys were gray, ashen gray. But there was a taller being, about 6 foot tall, who was not gray, but was kind of a pale pink with a bit of ashen color to it. But this being had larger than average eyes, black, wore a uniform with a V-neck. Whatever this thing was clearly in charge. It carried itself with an air of authority. I never saw it communicate with anybody, but my gut told me this was the guy that was running the show.
How tall was this being in charge?
A little over 6 foot tall.
Over 6 feet.
I can't move my head, but I can move my eyes. And I could see that there was motion, and I moved my eyes as far left as I could. And at that same instant, this guy must have turned to his right. The being raised its hand. It raised its hand from down below its waist to up about chest height. That's the only way that I knew that there were four long fingers, because when it turned and we locked eyes, it moved its arm across its upper torso, and that's when I saw the four long fingers. And I think it was by accident we locked eyes. In that millisecond when we established contact with our eyes, that thing was in my head. Felt like it knew me. It knew my wife, it knew my plans, it knew my secrets, it knew everything about me. What I got back from those eyes was raw intellect. There wasn't an ounce of mercy or kindness or empathy or anything that's good, nothing good. I got the feeling that it was there collecting information, like they were Darwin.
Wow, what a great story.
It is,
And I think that there are several insights where we are so far now tonight on COAST that tie in to some of the other things that I have heard from people who are military or other. And one of them is Lynn Buchanan, who was one of the remote viewers with the Defense Intelligence Agency back in the late 1980s. And that's when they were trying to do remote viewing for the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, on a kind of official business. And he told me about 3 years ago that just in the last few years that he has met and talked with one of his bosses at the Defense Intelligence Agency who told him that we actually do have interstellar trade, that we have missions, that we have military units that do and have gone to the moon, to Mars, out beyond, and that even beyond the Milky Way galaxy. Now, when I first heard that, like Lynn said, I know it doesn't seem possible when we think about the political chaos on our planet. But he said, Linda, I know this man. I trust him. And when he says that we already are in interstellar trade with allies, meaning that some of the beings are at least demonstrably allies to humanity and have been helping us, no matter what else might be out there that is hostile, that has the feeling of no compassion, no anything like this tall being. But that fits also into what DIA people have told me. And when he said they are like Darwin, I have been told that we essentially are a laboratory.
That's what we are.